let me tell you everything I said when you knew bloody well you'd be going back to whatever ducal palace in a week or so with your whole month's experience of being like people, and I was nothing but a diversion.
You weren't that, Cassian said. That's not true.
I've been sitting here for the last hour thinking of a way for us to be together. But there isn't one, is there? You've known that all along, and you made sure I didn't. I thought you were someone I could be with, and you let me think that. You let me hope. That was cruel. I didn't think you were cruel.
I didn't mean to be, the Duke said, his voice dry and scratchy.
But you were. Stop talking to me. I don't want to hear any more.
He was throwing his things into a bag haphazardly.
So few things.
The Duke swallowed down the lump in his throat.
I have that £50.
Keep it, Daisel said, not looking round. He fastened the bag.
I owe you.
Yes, you do.
And I'm not having you tell yourself it's all right because you gave me money.
He hoisted the bag and walked out. The Duke stared after him, hand over his mouth. And as Daisel slammed the door behind him, he crumpled to the floor. He left the Green Lion an hour later, when he was sure Daisel had gone, sped on his way by an extremely unfriendly look from Forster. He'd stay in a different place tonight, and leave Coventry in the morning, he decided, although he had no idea where he'd go. He ought not stay in a place with a reputation for mollying, even if that reputation was confined to people who wouldn't object. He was, after all, a duke. He went instead to one of the better hostelries Coventry had to offer, and commanded a room of his own, a bath, and the cleaning of his linen and boots, and sat in one of the public rooms afterwards with a book he didn't want to read, alone. If he'd been in the Green Lion, he could have talked to the casual friends he'd made. Except they all liked Daisel, and he'd hurt him. So none of them would have talked to him anymore. If he'd been in the Green Lion with Daisel, if he were there, he would be happy. As it was, he was as lonely and miserable as he'd been in his life. He had some 10 days left of his holiday, which felt more like an exile. He ought to make use of it somehow, though all he wanted to do was curl up on his empty bed. Leamington Spa was south of here, but his married cousin Louisa lived there with her husband, a solicitor, and there was too great a risk he might bump into her. He adored Louisa, who came between Leo and Matthew, and had grown up racing around Staplow with the boys. And he would have liked nothing more than to stay with her now, the bet be damned. But if he did that, he'd have to talk about how he was. That meant lying, if only by omission. And he couldn't stomach any more lies to people he loved. Not Leamington Spa, then. He flicked through Patterson's British itinerary and saw Kenilworth. It was only a single stage away. He'd go to Kenilworth because it was somewhere to go, and because moving was better than staying still, and because he had absolutely nothing better to do with his stupid ducal self. He went the next morning after a mostly sleepless night in an excessively large bed. He found where the stage went from and took a ticket and claimed his place, wondering as he did it how this had all seemed so daunting just a few weeks back. Because he'd been inexperienced, of course, and because he'd been alone. Everything was worse when you were alone. Kenilworth proved to be a pleasant market town. It wasn't hard to find the ruins of the castle, a great mass of red stone, still standing tall, its bones bare and magnificent. The Duke strolled around, trying to make himself be awed by the history. Here, Simon de Montfort had besieged Prince Edward, unless it was the other way around. Here, the Lancastrian kings had plotted in the Wars of the Roses. Here, Queen Elizabeth had stayed, entertained and courted by Robert Dudley while he concealed his illicit marriage. That had ended badly for everyone. Dudley's tragic wife, and Dudley, who was suspected of her murder, and the Queen herself, who had died a virgin, or at least unwed. He didn't care. He'd have cared if he was telling Daisel all about it, and Daisel would have cared while he listened. But they weren't doing that. And the misery of that fact left him too exhausted to walk further. He plodded to a grassy bank that seemed reasonably dry and sat on it. It was another thing dukes didn't do. And he didn't care about that either. He'd wanted to be a nobody. And now he was, and he hated it. He'd liked being Mr. Cassian very well indeed, thanks to Daisel. But having nowhere to go and nothing to do and nobody to do it with, one couldn't enjoy that. That wasn't leisure or holiday. That was just filling time to get the day over with. Was this how Daisel felt? Drifting around in constant purposeless movement. He'd said he was lonely, but he'd never really elaborated on it, and Daisel elaborated on most things, except the ones that hurt. That urgency to talk, the readiness to fall in with any plan as long as it was a plan. The Duke could understand those things, given the sense of yawning purposelessness he felt after a single day without Daisel. Daisel needed company, and he thought he'd found it in Cassian. And the Duke had seen that, and let him believe it and go on believing, never admitting that Cassian didn't exist because he'd put his own selfish wants first. Because Dukes always came first. He hadn't meant to abandon Daisel. He clung on to that fact as if it was some sort of argument in his own favour. He had truly intended to find a way forward and, what, presented as a fait accompli? I've lied to you, but to make it better, I've decided your future for you as well. Daisel might not even have minded that so much. Heaven knew he was easygoing. If the Duke had told him the truth and offered him some sort of future, or even if he'd said, help me think of something, Daisel would have come to terms with it, he was sure. If the Duke had just told him. But he hadn't. He'd let Daisel hope and care under false pretenses because he'd been enjoying the pretense. That was what it came down to, and the shame made him writhe. You shit, Seven, he said aloud. It seemed the only possible word in the circumstances. You utter shit. He could have explained it. If Daisel had given him a chance to talk it out, he could have persuaded him, made him understand. Except that he'd had that chance every second they'd spent together, and hadn't taken it until his hand was forced. No wonder Daisel had walked out. No wonder he hadn't wanted to hear any more. Lord Hugo had told the Duke 100 times he needed to be more determined, more forthright. If he'd spoken up when he should have, he wouldn't be moping round a ruin. And Daisel wouldn't be. He tried to think of what Daisel was doing, and could only see his face, red with anger, glistening with tears. Was he alone? There had been no sign of the man Martin Nichols, and they'd been lovers once. Would Daisel have gone with him, for lack of other comfort? The Duke almost hoped so. He couldn't bear the thought of Daisel alone again, betrayed again. He couldn't do this. He couldn't just sit here and let the man he loved drift away. He would not. He'd find some sort of answer to how they could be together that didn't founder on the rocks of his dukedom and Daisel's shoddy, shabby reputation, and he would find Daisel and present it to him. Just as soon as he thought of what it would be. Restlessness propelled him to his feet. He marched around the picturesque scene, cudgeling his brains. He cursed Daisel's father, the wretched villain, and the damn fool position it had left Daisel in. Notorious, barely educated, at once too much a gentleman and not quite enough of one. Could he be a permanent guest at Ducal Staplow, when his own family didn't count him worthy? Would he even want to live at Staplow, with Lord Hugo and Aunt Hilda and probably their strong opinions on George Charnage? The Duke very much doubted it. Sometimes 100 rooms didn't feel enough. He had to find an answer of some kind. He couldn't let this go. Even if they couldn't be together, he couldn't let Daisel be lonely. It wasn't fair. He strode forward, brow ferociously knit, and almost collided with a tall lady. I beg your pardon, he said briskly. Not at, oh, Mr. The voice was terribly familiar. The Duke actually looked at her and saw, with a sinking feeling, Miss Beaumont. Good heavens, he said. Miss Beaumont, I thought you were in Scotland, or have you come back? He added with a sudden hope. Should I be offering my congratulations, Mrs. Marston?
No.
Oh.
I did not get married,
she said in a tight sort of voice. Her big grey eyes looked rather red.
Mr. Marston chose... We had an argument.
Oh. The Duke glanced around. Where is he?
I couldn't say. I left him in Manchester.
Oh. He wished he had something else to say to this litany of disaster.
Then who was your attendance?
She shot him a vicious look.
I don't have any attendance. I ran away from my guardian to elope, and now I haven't even eloped, and I've nowhere to go, so how could I have attendance?
You came down from Manchester alone? Dear God. But regrettably, his duty was clear, and the Duke always did his duty. There is a bench over there. Would you like to sit down and talk about it? Miss Beaumont would. She poured out a tearful but reasonably coherent account of the journey from Stratford to Manchester, in which she freely admitted becoming exasperated by her intended.
He was so slow. He was so dreadfully bad at all of the deceiving people we had to do. And Mr. Charnage said we should get to the coast and take a boat, but Tony, Mr. Marston, wouldn't because he gets seasick of all the stupidnesses, and I dare say I was terribly impatient with him, but really, he exasperated me dreadfully, and then by the time we got to Manchester and we'd argued for a day or so, he asked me, did I truly love him, or did I merely want to marry him to escape Sir James? And I just couldn't say it. I suppose that's even wickeder than eloping, isn't it? Eloping with someone I didn't even love, only I did, I'm sure, when I was 17, but I'm 20 now, and we haven't spent much time together in years, and I'm sure he wasn't so tiresome before, but he said I wasn't even marrying him for his money, I was marrying him for my money, which was worse, and he didn't want to be a cipher in his own life, and I just used him as a means to my freedom. That was awfully unkind, you know, because it was true. I wished it wasn't, but it was.
Yes, the Duke said, that does hurt. She sniffed.
He said if I didn't care for him, he certainly didn't want my money.
That was good of him.
I dare say it was very noble, but I was furious. We'd come all the way up to Manchester and gone through all this inconvenience so I could marry him. There he was, refusing, which left me in the most dreadful scrape. And really, what was I to do? I suppose he wanted me to tell him I was sorry and he was wonderful, but honestly, I thought he was being a self-centered oaf. I was marrying him to be free of Sir James, and if he wanted something more, it was quite right he shouldn't marry me, but for heaven's sake, could he not have raised the subject before Manchester? So I left.
And he let you come back all this way on your own?
He said if I didn't love him, then I should do as I pleased. I think he was expecting me to cajole him into a good humour.
The Duke thought about that. A young lady unchaperoned and miles from home, being told by the man with power over her future to prove her love, and took a breath. I would like a word with Mr. Marston.
I did hurt his feelings awfully,
Miss Beaumont said fair-mindedly.
I know I shouldn't have done it, but I truly thought we'd rub along so much better than we did. After all, once we were married, we'd have lots of money, and that solves most problems, doesn't it? And I didn't lie to him. One might have thought he'd prefer an honest arrangement to a flattering deception. Then, if he'd truly thought I was heels over head for him in the first place, I can see why he was disappointed. I've made an awful mull of this.
Something of one, the Duke was forced to admit. And what now? Why are you here?
I have to be somewhere,
Miss Beaumont said bleakly.
I took the stage south on my own, which has been really quite unpleasant. I bought a ring on Mr. Jarnage's advice. Is he not here?
No, we're not travelling together any more.
Oh,
she said with clear disappointment.
Well, the ring helped, but all the same. Anyway, I got to Birmingham and realised I didn't know what I was coming back for. I've no family, and my trustee has made it very clear he doesn't want to be troubled, and I cannot go back to Sir James.
No, you can't. Not after this escapade. If he finds out...
But I don't know what else to do.
She sounded very young as she said that.
I've made such a dreadful, dreadful mistake. I should have lied, shouldn't I? I should have told Tony he was wonderful and flattered him into a better mood.
No, you should not, the Duke said. What you should have done from the start is found a lawyer who would act on your behalf if your trustee won't. She shot him a look.
I wrote to 5 lawyers. Only one of them wrote back, and he did so directly to Sir James as my guardian. I am underage and a woman. They won't listen to me.
And the rush to a hasty marriage would not make her seem any more worth listening to. The Duke didn't point that out. Have you met anyone you know on your travels? Can anyone, except Mr. Marston, I suppose, say for certain you eloped?
Well, I did leave that note for Sir James saying I was running away with Mr. Charnage.
But you could argue that was to throw him off the track. What we need is...
Oh.
She straightened at his tone.
Have you an idea? What is it, Mr...
Cassian, the Duke said, yet again. What we need is a respectable married woman who will take you in and be ready to swear you have been staying with her these past days. You left that note and ran to her house. We'll say she's an old friend. And you can stay with her while we instruct a lawyer who will look into your case, or at worst, fend off Sir James until you come of age.
I do see that would be marvellous,
Miss Beaumont said politely.
Do you happen to know any such lady?
My cousin Louisa. She lives perhaps 6 miles from here.
Oh, really? But are you sure she'll agree to that if she is a respectable woman?
She's a very respectable woman indeed, married to a successful solicitor, and she has the soul of a pirate. Shall we pay a call? Miss Beaumont clasped her hands, face alight.
Then something changed in her features. Wait, you are very kind to offer that, but why would you?
Because you are in a deal of trouble, and it appears to be my role to help you out of it. You can't expect me to say I'm sorry to hear it and leave you in trouble.
You could,
Miss Beaumont pointed out.
Lots of people would, almost everyone actually, and, Mr. Cassian, I don't at all wish to offend you or to make unfair implications, but I also don't wish you to have the wrong idea just because I have happened to elope with 2 gentlemen already. I think I have learned my lesson.
Good. And, if I may reciprocate your frankness, I have no designs on your person, your hand, or your money, the Duke said firmly. I am very well breeched on my own account. I doubt you and I would suit, and my affections are already and entirely given elsewhere. In fact, I must beg you to take the greatest pains to avoid any possible imputation of impropriety. We will travel by the public stage. She gave him a glowing look, apparently believing the precaution was for her benefit rather than his. Call it both, the Duke thought.
Thank you. That is exceedingly gentlemanly.
Chapter 14 Miss Beaumont's courage lasted until they arrived at Louisa's house. The Duke's was faltering a little too. It was evening, and Louisa might well look askance at his arrival. It couldn't be helped. A maid answered the door. Mrs. Kentridge, wife to a country solicitor, lived in significantly less magnificence than had Miss Louisa Cross, granddaughter to 7. But from all the Duke had seen, she was blissfully happy in her provincial surrounds. Please tell Mrs. Kentridge it is her cousin, Sev, the Duke said, hoping the maid wouldn't make the connection. She apparently did not, escorting him and Miss Beaumont in without much ceremony, and they waited in the drawing room until Louisa entered, wearing a very wary look.
Good evening,
she began, and then,
Sev, it is you. What on earth?
Hello, Louisa. The Duke jumped up and kissed her soundly on the cheek. I told your maid your cousin Sev, did she not say so?
She said exactly that, and I assumed she'd run mad. Is this to do with your absurd wager?
Yes, I have heard all about it, but good heavens, I beg your pardon, she added, casting an assessing eye over Miss Beaumont.
Sev, you will surely introduce your companion.
Miss Eliza Beaumont, Mrs. Louisa Kentridge. The ladies exchanged bows. Miss Beaumont was now bright red. Miss Beaumont is a friend of mine who has suffered a misfortune.
Misfortune?
Louisa repeated. Yes. In fact, I have come to ask if she can stay.
Stay with us?
With you. Louisa looked at her, then at him, and inhaled deeply. It was very like the way Uncle Hugo inhaled before explosion, and the Duke cut her off in some haste.
Pray, listen, Miss Beaumont has been through a shocking time, and she is in grave need of help. I require a respectable matron of unimpeachable virtue to stand for her, and an excellent lawyer to fight for her.
So I came here. She has been shockingly treated.
I dare say.
It is quite amazing how many pretty young ladies are shockingly treated and require the help of susceptible young men. Louisa said, with a decided chill in her voice. Miss Beaumont made a stifled noise.
The Duke said, Louisa, that is grossly unfair. You know very well that I am not susceptible, and you know nothing of Miss Beaumont at all.
I quite agree the situation is unconventional, but I am trying to make it conventional as quickly as possible for the sake of a lady.
I hope that you will help me.
She did not look to be in a helpful mood.
This seems scarcely appropriate.
Indeed it is not, the Duke said. But I am not bringing immorality into your house, and I am sorry you should think that of me.
I should not make any such accusation,
Louisa informed him loftily.
So what precisely are you bringing into my house?
It's a long story which I shall tell you presently, but...
He needed the big guns. Harum scarum, Lou. It was the term they had used as children. The one that commanded utter loyalty in the teeth of authority. A call of harum scarum obliged the hearer to tell barefaced lies.
No, I have not seen Louisa anyway. Is it really time for her piano lesson?
Or to take any measure necessary to support the caller? Leo had invoked harum scarum on the never-to-be-sufficiently-bemoaned by Uncle Hugo occasion they'd decided it was necessary to walk round the complete span of the castle atop the battlements. And the Duke had even claimed it was his idea when retribution descended. He had scarcely ever invoked it himself. Maybe it was time. Louisa's lips had parted. She said with concentrated force,
Brothers, you, goodness me.
Please,
Miss Beaumont said with difficulty,
if Mrs. Kentridge does not wish to accommodate me.
Not at all, Louisa said swiftly. No, I made a foolish assumption and I beg your pardon.
And it is certainly too late for you to go anywhere this evening.
She moved to ring the bell.
So I shall have a room made up and you shall go upstairs and wash, Miss Beaumont, while my cousin explains to me exactly what is going on. Will you stay with us tonight, Sev?
No, I shall take a room somewhere. He had no intention of spending a night under the same roof as Miss Beaumont for both their sakes.
You must at least remain for dinner.
I shall send to the Star for a room for you. A maid arrived. Louisa gave a series of orders that ended with Miss Beaumont being swept upstairs with a program of tea, washing, and settling in. Louisa waited for the door to shut, turned to the Duke, and said,
Is this an elopement? Oh, Sev, is it a wedding?
It is neither, and I intend to keep it that way. Miss Beaumont has no interest in me.
Fiddle.
She's an heiress in her own right. Listen. You know about my wager with Leo,
of course. He is staying here too. He and Father have been arguing uphill and down dale over the bet and his losses to that ghastly Sir James.
Ah, the Duke grimaced. I hope he doesn't consider my calling on you to infringe the terms.
I needed to do something with Miss Beaumont. Leo will do as he's told. I want to know everything immediately.
He explained the situation. Louisa had the quality, rare in the Cross family, of being able to hear a story without undue interruption. She listened as the Duke outlined his travels, touching as lightly as possible on his travelling companion because he did not trust himself to talk about Daisel. He explained Miss Beaumont's predicament and actions very frankly, since Louisa should know what she might be getting into, and at the end she drew a long breath.
Good heavens, Sev, you have been going it.
I know.
No wonder you look exhausted. And you have taken Miss Beaumont under your wing because...
Someone had to.
Could you have walked away seeing her alone?
Yes, Louisa said crisply.
The little fool seems to have brought much of her trouble on herself and encountered a great deal less than she might have,
running around the country with men.
I suppose she's an innocent one would have to be so very stupid.
She isn't stupid, she's inexperienced, and she was facing the prospect of Sir James pressing his suit.
True,
Louisa admitted.
Is he as vile as all that?
Leo held strong views on him, but then he owes the fellow a lot of money. Dreadful. He is a vicious swine who employs violent brutes and beats his horses unmercifully. I have no doubt he would beat his wife. But if he was the most virtuous man alive, she doesn't like him, and that should suffice. She nodded slowly,
You are a good man, Sev, and Miss Beaumont is fortunate. What do you intend?
I'd like you to keep her. Perhaps give her some useful advice, he added in the certain knowledge that Louisa wouldn't be able to stop herself. If you felt able to say that she came directly to you from Vere's house.
Are you asking me to lie, Your Grace?
We could call it a benevolent deception, if you prefer.
I'll have to talk to Kentridge about that, Louisa said. What else?
Kentridge's help. Miss Beaumont needs a lawyer who will prod her trustee into action and take steps against Vere. Break the guardianship if possible, or at least keep her out of his clutches. I don't know what can be done, but he doubtless will, and he is welcome to use my name.
That is liable to attract comment.
Are you quite sure?
Positive.
She has no interest at all in marrying me, nor I her. Indeed, she would not have accepted my help if I had not assured her that it came without any expectation on my part or obligation on hers.
Fiddle, Louisa said again. I don't wish to offend you, Seth, but one might see this as a well-woven trap, and you are a catch.
I think you will find she's rather too straightforward for that, the Duke said.
And she doesn't know who I am.
I beg your pardon. Hence, the cousin Sev. She knows me as Mr. Cassian because of the bet, and I have not disabused her. He'd put yesterday's confrontation to the back of his mind for a little while, relieved to be concentrating on Miss Beaumont's woes and enjoying Louisa's company instead. Now his betrayal and Daisel's hurt came rushing back, with all the more force for having been briefly pent up. He swallowed.
I hid my name all the time.
Lied to people.
Sev?
It's nothing, nothing. It's been a peculiar time for me.
She gave him a long examining look and shook her head.
Brother Leo and his foolish wagers.
Don't blame Leo. I wanted this and it has been. I would not have missed it for the world. With everything, I would not have missed it.
She was watching him, looking puzzled and a little concerned, and he forced a smile.
I have learned a great deal.
Partly I have learned that anonymity is a curse as well as a blessing.
And now I shall have to tell Miss Beaumont I am a duke, which will be embarrassing.
More so for her, I expect.
Yes.
The Duke winced internally on Miss Beaumont's behalf. He was deeply glad she had spoken so frankly about her sentiments, or lack of them, towards him, but he suspected she might not feel the same.
Could we perhaps tell her after dinner?
I should prefer her to be comfortable.
She would not be more comfortable with me if I started by colluding to deceive her, Louisa said.
For goodness sake. Now that sounds like Leo coming in. You may greet him and at least wash before we dine, because you may be anonymous, but there is no need to look like the scaff and raff. I shall have Miss Beaumont down here for you to speak to after that.
Dinner was a great deal more enjoyable than the Duke could have predicted. Leo greeted him with great good humour, and was easily persuaded under his sister's quelling eye to agree that this family dinner lay outside the terms of the wager. Miss Beaumont had been incredulous and horrified to learn of Mr. Cassian's true identity, but she carried on bravely despite her natural mortification, aided by Leo's clear admiration. He was a tall, well-built man with a deal of charm, most unlike his titled cousin, and he chaffed the Duke about his deception in a way that soon had Miss Beaumont daring to giggle.
It does seem a quite extraordinary thing to be doing, Mr. Your Grace, she said.
Seven, the Duke said. That was a perfectly respectable mode of address for a family friend. And perhaps it is a little odd.
Absolutely absurd, Louisa said. You and Leo are nothing but a pair of schoolboys.
I don't quite agree, my dear, James Kentridge remarked. He was rather older than his wife, an intelligent man with a deceptively sleepy look. As I understand it, Seven set out on his adventure with a purpose.
I did.
The Duke caressed the ring with the pad of his thumb, checking it was there as he had done no more than 50 or 60 times that day. I wanted experience of life which one cannot get from a castle window, or the bow window either. I wanted to encounter people and see how they saw me. As me, not as my position. I wanted to prove to myself that I could manage. I don't know if I have achieved that entirely. I have failed badly at some things, but I have certainly learned.
To use the stage?
Leo asked. To use the stage, to order my own meals and tend to my own belongings, and to decide the course of my own days. That may not sound much to you, but then you have not always been wrapped in lamb's wool. He paused. Also, I escaped from kidnappers. That created a suitable effect. In fact, Leo choked on a mouthful of wine. The Duke told the story, eliciting gasps and laughs in a very satisfactory manner. Possibly he had learned a little from the evenings in the Green Lion. Miss Beaumont seemed entirely unsurprised by his account of the men Sir James had sent after her. But Leo grew red with fury on both her and the Duke's behalf. The man is a dashed villain, he said. A villain, I say. To send the sort of beasts who would manhandle Miss Beaumont.
And who did manhandle Seven, Louisa said. I trust you intend to repay that, Sev.
I do, yes, the Duke said. Mostly by removing Miss Beaumont and her wealth from his grasp. Kentridge, I hope you will be able to act for me there.
I can certainly speak to your lawyers in London, and I know George Boyson, Miss Beaumont's trustee, slightly, Kentridge said. He is disinclined to make trouble on himself. But I expect he might be persuaded that your displeasure is potentially more troublesome than Vere's.
Do tell him that. I shall be happy to make it good.
Absolutely right. Vere must not be allowed to get hold of Miss Beaumont again, Leo said.
I won't have it. You are so very kind, Mr. Cross,
Miss Beaumont said, cheeks pinking, apparently unaware that the Duke and Mr. Kentridge would be doing all the work.
It sounds as though Sir James is as malevolent as Leo has said, Louisa remarked. Why did your father put you in his hands, Miss Beaumont? My father wasn't terribly pleasant either. They were business partners, and Sir James can be charming and plausible.
Leo snorted disbelief. Louisa ever sisterly remarked,
Well, he persuaded you to play with him.
Repeatedly.
Oh, I hope you did not, Miss Beaumont said. He cheats.
Every head turned to her.
I beg your pardon, the Duke said. Sir James cheats at cards, at whist at least. He has a system with his friend Sir Francis Plath. I hope you weren't playing with them, Mr. Cross.
They played as partners, Leo said grimly. When you say cheat,
they have a way of signalling what cards they have and want the other to play. If he says gentlemen before they start, he's saying he is strong in hearts, that is, has good cards or a lot of them,
she glossed helpfully, and
trifle indicates strong in diamonds. So he might say, excuse me, gentlemen, a trifling cough, or let me not trifle further, gentlemen. And both of them mean that he has hearts and diamonds. Come, as in, come, your card, or will you come to dinner tomorrow, means he wants Plath to lead a spade, but if he says Plath with it, it means to play a low spade. That sort of thing. It has to be very subtle so as not to be obvious when they do it. I have heard them rehearse it.
Leo was going purple. Mr. Kentridge said,
Really? That is exceedingly interesting.
Interesting? Leo exploded. It's blasted disgraceful.
Yes, said Kentridge. Do you think you could write down everything you recall of his system, Miss Beaumont? And Leo, not a word of this. No posting back to London to confront him.
Don't tell anyone at all.
Leo blinked at his formidable brother-in-law.
What? Of course we must.
I think Kentridge means keep quiet until the right time, the Duke said. Kentridge gave him an approving nod.
This may be an opportunity, a weapon even. But he must not be alerted too soon. Does he know you know about this, Miss Beaumont?
I don't think so. I was eavesdropping, she said frankly. One had to in that horrid house.
We will consider the matter well before we act, Kentridge said. The first concern must be to extricate Miss Beaumont from Vere's guardianship. She should, I think, stay here, as Severn has suggested. I shall go down to London to put matters in motion. If Vere is capable of sending bravos after her, it might be best if Leo also stays in my absence. It would be my privilege, Leo told Miss Beaumont. We shall cut our cloth, depending on what I can find out. As to the matter of cheating, we shall keep it in hand and consider when best to strike. Goodness me, Kentridge, Louisa said with a curl in her voice. How ruthless. What about you, Sev? Leo asked, evidently reluctant to observe his sister making eyes at her husband. I'm not going to act until Kentridge has had a chance to get to the lie of the legal hand, the Duke said. Meanwhile, I have some 10 days to go on our wager. Oh, nonsense, Leo said in chorus with Louisa. You must see this is more important. I absolve you. You will do no such thing. It is a wager and I want to complete it. And really, this is best not in my hands. I don't greatly want Vere to find out that I was directly responsible for aiding his ward's flight or abetting the deception of a vicar. Over what? Louisa demanded.
Oh, but that wasn't you, it was Mr. Charnage, Miss Beaumont said.
Charnage, Leo repeated. He couldn't avoid it any longer. That's right, a gentleman I travelled with for a while. Which Charnage, because as far as I know, of the men of that name, Daisel. You cannot mean that. Leo sounded distressingly like his father. Are you serious? No relation of George Charnage, I hope, Louisa put in. His son. What? Sev, you've gone mad, Leo said bluntly. Daisel Charnage, travelling with you? For the Lord's sake, man, it's one thing not to be high in the instep, but... He is not responsible for his father's crime. It is a great shame he has been punished for it.
He was very kind and pleasant,
Miss Beaumont offered, looking from face to face.
Oh, pleasant, absolutely, Leo said. Very likeable fellow. Nevertheless...
No, not nevertheless. The Duke could feel his cheeks heating. Daisel cannot be blamed for what his father did.
Oh, yes, he can. The sins of the fathers are visited on the children, like it or not,
Louisa said.
And as I understand it, he's done plenty of his own accord. Was there not an elopement? That was me,
Miss Beaumont said meekly, looking at her plate.
But it was not his fault precisely.
It was a complicated situation, the Duke said. And half of what is said about him is Vere's spite, which comes back to what George Charnage did.
He was unquestionably running a gaming ring at Eton, Leo said. I should know, he cleaned me out twice. Honestly, Sev, there is adventure and there is mere recklessness. What are the chances he recognized you? What will you do if he goes around claiming a close friendship with you? If he uses your name or turns up at Staplow, presuming on your acquaintance?
I should be very glad to welcome him to Staplow. Under the cover of the table, the Duke was twisting his napkin tighter and tighter. He is my friend.
For pity's sake, I can see you have been living it up on your holiday, and I always liked Charnage, and I dare say it isn't fair, but life is not fair. Severn cannot be friends with his sort, and that is all there is to it.
Perhaps Severn can't, the Duke agreed with a dry mouth. As with all the many things that Severn must and must not do. I understand they matter, but do I not matter? I cannot be Severn all the time, only doing what Severn does and behaving as Severn must, with no life of my own that is not Severn. I will die in there. Louisa frowned.
Are you all right, Sev?
I have no idea what you mean, Leo said briskly. The fact is, you have your position and you have its obligations, and can you imagine what father would say, knowing you were associating with George Charnage's son, giving him countenance?
Still, he won't let the fellow set foot in Staplow, so I dare say there's no great harm done.
The Duke stared at his plate. Then he looked up. Remind me, he said. Who is the Duke of Severn? Louisa and Leo exchanged glances. Louisa said,
Sev?
Who? You, Leo said, of course, but
Who is master at Staplow?
Leo tried for a joke.
Well, that's a tricky...
Who?
The Duke shouted, and saw his cousin recoil.
By God, I will not have this! Constant dictation of what the Duke may do and how and who with. I will decide what I do and make friends as I please. Who the devil are you to tell me otherwise? If people don't like my choice of friends, they may set themselves outside my acquaintance, and if the family don't like my guests in my house, they are not obliged to live there. I will have no more of this accursed trammelling. I am a grown man, and the obligations and duties of my station do not extend to having my friends selected for me. How dare you tell me who I may care for?
He was standing, fists planted on the tablecloth. He wasn't sure when he'd got up.
Leo and Louisa were both bright red.
Kentridge watched with interest.
Miss Beaumont's eyes were wide.
And I will tell you this,
the Duke added furiously.
Daisel Charnage has been unfairly maligned, and I will not have it. If he has my countenance, and he does because he is my friend, then any man who chooses to abuse or to cut him on his father's account offends Severn. I shall make that known, and we will see how the sheep of the polite world behave when the dog barks.
He stopped there, for lack of anything else to say, heart pounding. He'd never in his life lost his temper so comprehensively or shouted so much.
Leo's mouth was set tight. I must beg your grace's pardon for any offence I have given.
Shut up, you fool, his sister hissed.
The Duke looked between them, and quite suddenly could not bear any more. I apologize for raising my voice, but you must understand. It is not tolerable. I will not tolerate it.
I think I should go. I have somewhere to travel tomorrow.
I hope I can safely leave Miss Beaumont with you.
Of course, Louisa said.
Take whatever time you need, Sev. I hope we will see you soon.
The Duke nodded to them all and walked out. As he left, Leo started to speak. Louisa told him to shut up again. The Duke set off for Coventry the next morning, in a curricle hired at the best livery stable Leamington Spa had to offer, drawn by the fastest pair they could provide. Be damned the bet. He'd learned the hard way how difficult it was to track a man down once you no longer had his trail. He was going to find Daisel. He was going to apologize. Fully. Humbly. As he should have done at the time. And he was going to offer all the power at his disposal to end the ostracism that Daisel had suffered for his miserable parents and Sir James Vere's spite, along with the odd indiscretion that was really no worse than anyone else's. He'd do that whether Daisel wanted any more of him or not, because it was right. That vow, and the pleasure of driving himself in a well-sprung conveyance at a satisfactory speed, carried him all the way to the Green Lion in Coventry, where Forster, the landlord, seemed unexcited to see him, and suggested he might want to leave. Cassian felt warmly towards him for his defence of Daisel, but had no intention of taking the dismissal. I need to know where Daisel went, he repeated politely. It is important I find him.
Look, mate, your quarrels aren't my business.
No, they are not. Answer me, please. Possibly the landlord saw something in his face because he said,
he headed south, went to meet Martin at the Rising Crown in Leamington,
where Cassian had just come from. Marvellous.
He changed horses and headed back, cursing Martin Nichols.
Why was Daisel travelling with that blasted man, and fate, and mostly himself?
At the Rosen Crown, he learned that he had missed Daisel by some 36 hours. He and Nichols had taken the coach towards Worcester. Cassian took this news with as much grace as he could, considering he seemed to be fated to drive in circles. He was going to find Daisel, and he was going to apologize if it was the last thing he did. 2 days later, he broke the journey at the March Hare in Broughton Hackett. He hoped only to get some sort of lead there before arriving in Worcester. Instead, he walked into the inn and straight into John Martin.
You, Cassian said.
Oh, God. Martin sounded exhausted, and looked it too, his eyes dark-ringed.
Look, sir, your grace, if you're planning to have me arrested...
I don't care about you. Where is Dazel?
Martin opened his mouth, hesitated, and considered him for a moment.
What for? Because I want to talk to him.
What do you intend by him?
That's none of your affair. Hurt or help?
Martin demanded. They were having this conversation in a passageway in low voices. It was probably indiscreet. Cassian didn't care.
Because you've given him quite enough hurt, and if you mean more, well.
Which is it? I want to speak to him, and I mean him no harm, and...
He had no desire to reveal anything to Martin, considering. But the man was defending Dazel. The Duke had a momentary mental image of Dazel taking comfort in his old lover's arms, and quashed it. If he'd driven Dazel to that, it was his own fault.
I need to apologize. I hope he will hear me. Maybe he won't, but that is his choice, not yours.
He held Martin's gaze. If he doesn't want to speak to me, I'll leave. Martin examined his face a moment longer. And what if he needs help? Would you act for him, your grace? Or is it more important to stay incognito? His tone was aggressive, but there was something raw in it, and Cassian's spine prickled.
What do you mean, help? What's happened? Is something wrong?
You might say so. He's in jail.
Chapter 15. Dazel sat in the cell, arms on his knees and head in his hands, wondering if he could identify the point at which his life had gone quite so badly wrong. It depended where you wanted to start. Being fathered by George Charnage had been a tactical error from which he'd never recovered. Expulsion from Eton had primed the world to take a dim view of him. He could have handled himself better around his father's crime instead of his bewildered efforts to defend his parents, not to mention the drinking. The obscene profiles had been enormous fun to do at the time, but he should have ensured they were gathered up and burned. He probably shouldn't have tried to elope with Miss Beaumont, and he should never, ever have talked to Cassian, or agreed to travel with Cassian, or fallen in love with Cassian. Perhaps that wasn't the stupidest thing he'd done in his life, but it felt like it. His wretched idiocy, his self-delusion, his pathetic need for once not to be disposed of as a trivial obstacle to someone else's life. They stewed miserably in his stomach, unless that was the jail food. If he wasn't a bloody fool, he would have realized that Cassian was far more than he said. Perhaps they might have set up a sensible sort of arrangement, one where they could be friends who fucked, and Dazel lived at the Duke's expense. A kept man, as Martin had suggested. That would have been the sensible thing to do if he could have borne it, if he'd kept his head and negotiated a satisfactory bargain. If he hadn't wanted Cassian to love him. He didn't want to be Cassian's shameful secret or paid bedmate. He wanted Cassian as he'd had him over the last glorious weeks. Friend and lover and companion. There all the time with his sun and rain eyes. That wondering, hopeful smile. But he wasn't going to have that because Cassian was the Duke of Severn. If he wasn't a damned needy fool, he could at least have taken the news with grace and had another week. He could have taken the 50 quid, come to that. It would have helped. And while he was on the subject, he could have refrained from punching Mr. Thomas Acaster in the face. He'd quite forgotten about that business on their travels, relegating the coach spill to his collection of unwanted memories, and entirely disregarding the little turd who'd caused it. He certainly hadn't considered the matter as he and Martin had made their desultory, unenthusiastic way towards Worcester. He'd had other things on his mind. It had been a miserable journey. Martin might have intended sympathy, but nothing he said had actually supplied it. And in any case, he wasn't Cassian. Dazel wanted Cassian so badly he felt sick with it, and couldn't seem to come to terms with the fact that he didn't exist. They'd got off the stage at wherever it was, some place so trivial Dazel couldn't even recall its name, because they were both fed to the back teeth of the journey and each other's company. And who had they encountered but Mr. Tom Acaster? Dazel hadn't even noticed him. He'd spotted Dazel all right, and brought a constable. Dazel had been promptly hauled before the local magistrate, one Sir Benjamin Acaster. That had gone as well as might be expected. Sir Benjamin had listened to his son's complaint, examined Dazel by bellowing abuse at him without letting him get a word in, and committed him to prison to await trial. And here he was in a cell, glaring alternately at the dirt-streaked, lime-washed walls and the earthen floor. Cold and damp and hungry, in expectation of a trial that was to be conducted by, wait for it, Sir Benjamin Acaster. Which meant he was doomed. In a fair hearing, he might point out the context of his assault on the young man, but he wasn't going to have one of those. Nor would there be anyone to appeal to. Magistrates were meant to sit in pairs, but the turnkey had informed him that Sir Benjamin sat alone and liked it that way. Sir Benjamin wouldn't want to send Dazel to the assizes, where he risked a more severe punishment but would at least get a hearing. Instead, he would use his powers of summary justice. That, as he had said with relish at the preliminary examination, meant a whipping. There would probably be a fine, too, and since Dazel had no way to pay such a thing, he was inevitably looking at a spell in jail as well. Dazel wasn't sure which prospect was the worst. He did not want to be whipped. The idea made him feel sick. He'd been caned at school and that had hurt, but whipping. He'd seen the mess that made of men's backs. He was not stoic about bodily harm, and his gorge rose at the thought of the pain, the shame, the scarring. He didn't want to be a jailbird either. He hadn't conducted himself with any great righteousness throughout his adult life, and was used to being a gentleman of uncertain fortune and degraded reputation. But whipping and imprisonment meant a fall he'd probably never recover from. This was it. This was the moment he stopped being a not-quite-gentleman and became a marked, degraded scoundrel. He'd broken the magistrate's son's nose because he was a stupid, thoughtless fool, and he was going to pay in blood and skin and pain, and nobody was going to help him. Martin probably would if he could, but he couldn't, and Dazel had seen nothing of him since the arrest. Doubtless he had vanished away like a sensible man, and nobody else in the wide world cared an iota for Dazel. He wasn't going to wonder if Cassian cared. He'd felt a panicked impulse to call on the Duke of Severn's name in front of the magistrate and choked it down. It wouldn't work anyway. Who'd believe him? How could he prove it, with Cassian miles away and Lord knew where? And he'd consigned Cassian to the devil, so it wouldn't be fair to drag him into this. It wouldn't be fair anyway. This was Dazel's mess. Self-created, self-inflicted. It was time he faced up to that. And to the fact that nobody else was going to bring order or certainty or purpose to his life. He wouldn't find value in himself or anything else by drifting along, seeing where the currents took him for the rest of his life. He knew very well where they would take him. Inexorably downward till he drowned. So he'd endure the whipping and whatever other spites Sir Benjamin chose to mete out and wait for it to be over. And then he'd do something. Go and seek a place in one of the profile studios in London, or better, set up one of his own in a provincial town. Give up trying to be more than he was. Use the skill he had. Cut shades for shillings all day, every day. And if that felt desperately bleak, it was at least better than the pointless existence to which he'd let himself be habituated until Cassian had made him dream that he mattered. Dazel set his mind to that, trying to imagine himself enjoying life as an independent artisan rather than starving in a gutter, until the turnkey came to get him. He was marched into a mean and dingy room for trial, hands chained. It was hardly a courtroom, but justice round here was rudimentary at best. Sir Benjamin sat at a table that represented the bench, Dazel was shoved into a pew with the smirking Tom Acaster on the other side. His nose had set very badly, Dazel was pleased to note. A scattering of people sat to watch. Dazel didn't look at them. He didn't want to be gawped at. Sir Benjamin cleared his throat.
In the matter of common assault brought against Dazel Charnage by Thomas Acaster, these proceedings are unlawful.
That was Martin's voice. Dazel looked around sharply and saw him standing in the small crowd. The magistrate swelled.
I beg your pardon. Who are you, sir?
My name is John Martin, and I object. It is not right for the prosecutor's father to sit in judgment of this case. It should be heard by another magistrate.
How dare you? Sir Benjamin retorted. I am the magistrate here. I rule without favour. Is my son to be denied justice on the basis of his father's name? I think not, sir. He is the victim of a vicious assault, and I will judge the case with impartiality and discretion.
Martin scoffed. Dazel tried without success to catch his eye in order to indicate stop it. Sir, you are bent on vengeance rather than justice. This is not right. You should release the prisoner until a fair judge is found, since you are clearly no such thing. If Martin was trying to get him hanged, he was going the right way about it. Dazel would have liked to have his hands free just so he could put his face into them. He contemplated the reddening magistrate with a sinking heart.
How dare you insult my impartiality?
Sir Benjamin bellowed.
Be silent, or I will commit you for contempt of court.
Martin shrugged. He didn't back down easily in the face of threats. Though that trait was less admirable when Dazel would be the one paying for his insolence.
Very well, Your Honour. If that's how you want it, I submit a witness for the court.
Sir Benjamin's eyes bulged.
What witness? None has been bound over for the prosecution except my son. No other will be heard.
Martin smiled. It was not a pleasant smile.
I think Your Honour will find you wrong about that.
He sat down. Cassian stood up. Dazel's mouth dropped open. He'd been so busy gaping at Martin that he hadn't even noticed Cassian behind him, slim and unobtrusive. Now he walked up to the bench, and Dazel had no idea how he could have missed him. How anybody ever could.
What is this?
The magistrate demanded.
Who are you, fellow?
I am the Duke of Severn, Cassian said. You will address me as Your Grace.
Nonsense,
Sir Benjamin said with an incredulous laugh. He was seated. Cassian stood in front of him. But he didn't have the posture of most men in front of a magistrate. He was very definitely looking down, with an expression of remote displeasure. He wore his old coat, but the golden card case he took from his pocket was engraved. And when he placed a card on the bench with a click, the wrought gold ring gleamed on his finger. The magistrate picked up the card and his face changed. Probably a duke's cards felt expensive.
I am Severn, Cassian repeated, and his voice was different somehow.
Remote and very, very superior. I was travelling with the prisoner when the reckless stupidity of this man, your son, illegally tooling the coach in contravention of numerous bylaws, caused an accident. At least three people were extremely badly hurt, perhaps killed. I note none of them are here in this room where you propose to try, Mr. Charnage. A touch of anger in his voice now. Mr. Charnage saved the life of a child in the wreck, acted heroically afterwards in preventing further accident, and aided wounded passengers to escape the coach. While he did so, your son reeled around drunkenly, making oafish jokes, uncaring of the damage he had done. And now, you propose to abuse your position and carry out judicial vengeance on Mr. Charnage for his very natural anger, while your son goes unpunished for his reckless, drunken destruction. You disgrace your office, Sir Benjamin. This is contemptible. The magistrate was the red-purple colour of a raw steak, or an oncoming apoplexy. Cassian went on, voice low and steady, slim form upright, staring down at him as he sat. You are committing an egregious abuse of power, and I will not tolerate it. You are unfit for your post, sir, and your son is unfit for the company of gentlemen. I will make both of those things known across England. The magistrate opened his mouth. Cassian held up a finger. Weigh your words. I will brook no insolence.
But how do I know you are who you say you are?
I beg your pardon. His words fell like stones, clear and separate. And the magistrate swallowed.
That is, how do I know, your grace?
Cassian gave him a few seconds' silent scrutiny. You may send to my seat, Staplow, or to London to my solicitors, should you choose to doubt my word. If I am delayed on my travels by this, I will hold you responsible for any consequences. You will, in any case, release Mr. Charnage on my cognizance now while we wait for the proof you require. It is regrettable you have not applied such high standards of evidence in your judicial duties.
Your Grace, please.
Sir Benjamin was sweating visibly.
I'm sure we can discuss this as men of goodwill.
Goodwill? Cassian repeated. I think not. You take up my time. Will this prosecution go forward? The magistrate swallowed again and made a surreptitious gesture to his son, who croaked. No. His father positively snarled at him, and he amended it too.
No, Your Grace.
So Mr. Charnage is free to go? Sir Benjamin nodded eagerly.
Yes, Your Grace.
Then why is he still in irons? Cassian inquired, and the edge to his voice did more than any bellow could have achieved.
At once, Your Grace! Get on, you fool!
The magistrate snapped at the turnkey.
Your Grace, please believe that this unfortunate misunderstanding, a very natural inclination on a father's behalf, I beg your tolerance.
You seem not to grasp the issue, Sir Benjamin, Cassian said. I was in that coach. Your son could have killed 7. There will be consequences. Sir Benjamin's mouth opened and shut. Cassian stood in silence, back stiff with hauteur. His coat might have been ermine. He waited for Dazel to be freed, then turned and swept forward without a word to the magistrate, Dazel and Martin scrambling along in his wake. Dazel stepped out into his first fresh air and sunlight for 2 days, blinking. Cassian stopped in front of him and gave a tiny shudder, like a horse shaking off flies. Dazel shot a glance at Martin, who pulled an appalling face. When Cassian turned, he looked like himself again, without the cold, superior expression and upright bearing. Dazel, are you all right?
Yes.
He couldn't think of anything to say. Probably thank you would be appropriate, except he didn't want to, unless he did. He was suddenly very aware of his jail stink, of the fact he hadn't slept, washed or shaved in 2 days. Still less changed his linen. His coat was torn, his only coat. And he looked like what he was, a shabby ruffian. Cassian was a duke. Dazel wanted to demand, what are you doing here? Why did you come? But he wasn't sure he could bear the answer. Cassian seemed equally tongue-tied for all his earlier poise. They stared helplessly at each other. Martin looked between them and gave a sigh.
Daisy wants to talk to you. If you want to hear him out, he's taken a parlour in the inn. If you don't, we can go.
Please, Cassian said scratchily. Would you hear me out? Or even just let me apologize. Dazel nodded. Martin touched him on the arm. I'll get your things from the jail and be in the public if you need me. There was indeed a private parlor in the inn. They walked in and Cassian shut the door. Dazel wandered over to the other side of the room. He was slightly concerned this might be a dream, that of course the Duke of Severn had not appeared to save him, that he would wake again and still be alone and facing a whipping. "Days," Cassian said. He sounded real for what that was worth.
"Oh, Days,"